Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 11th, 2018. I was away from the secret studio yesterday shooting video. Met a lot of inspiring people, including a guy who's a paraplegic who is working on a master's degree at San Francisco State University. The video I'm working on is a series of short videos related to in-home health care services here in my home county, Marin County, California. And it's put me in touch with people who live with daily challenges that you and I never have to face. And they do it with incredible positive attitudes and resourcefulness. And I just had to share that with you because I came away richer for the experience. And I also want to tell you at the end of the podcast today, which is probably going to run longer than usual because I'm catching up on 2 days of news, I'm going to play for you the call that I returned after I got a really bad robocall on my cell phone announcing that the IRS is after me. And the guys that I caught in the boiler room are just cartoonish. You will find it amusing, I think. Nancy Pelosi is the leading Democrat in the House of Representatives. She will become Speaker again, she hopes, if Democrats retake the majority of the House in the midterm elections less than a month away. And as you may know, I know Nancy Pelosi. We have been in contact for years. She hired me as a consultant on her reelection campaign way back there 22 years ago in 1996. And on a personal basis, I love and admire Nancy Pelosi, and I appreciate the work she has done to break the glass ceiling and become a true leader. But I challenge her judgment on key issues these days. So, she told the San Francisco Chronicle editorial board yesterday that if Democrats take control, you can expect them to immediately try to force Trump to release his tax returns. Pelosi told the Chronicle, "Demanding the president's tax returns is one of the first things we do. That's the easiest thing in the world. That's nothing." Now, she wouldn't necessarily be able to release them to the public, but congressional committees have legal leverage to try to get the IRS to cough up Trump's tax returns. Now, to people who don't think that Trump should be impeached, who think that exposing his tax returns is sufficient, maybe this has some political weight to it. But it is such a tiny step. And last week, the New York Times, in a blockbuster lengthy report, exposed all of the tax fraud of Trump, father and son, going back over 25 years to show how Fred Trump showered his kids with cash, including, a couple of $100,000 for the toddler Donald. He was a millionaire by the age of 8, and daddy gave little Don $400 million over the years. And Trump lies and says, it was only $1 million and I paid it back with interest. So Pelosi seems to believe that her Democratic followers and people the Democrats are wooing to support candidates for the House in next month's election will be satisfied with the idea that the Democrats are really determined to get Trump's tax returns. This is so freaking pathetic. And to top it off, when asked about whether Democrats should pursue impeachment of the recently installed Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Nancy Pelosi said no. "No, I don't," she responded when asked if she thought impeaching Kavanaugh would be productive. "It's not about impeaching him." Now, I do understand the impediments to impeachment. We discussed them with John Bonifaz in our in-depth interview that I released earlier this week. And I am under no illusions that impeachment of Kavanaugh or Trump is easy or that it happens overnight. But somebody's got to start it. Somebody has to stand up and say, this is not acceptable. Whether it is Trump on the emoluments, on so many other issues where he has overreached or committed crimes. And then Kavanaugh, we've got the clear evidence of his perjury before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But Nancy Pelosi says impeachment is once again off the table. And the Chronicle reports that no Democrat in Congress so far has stepped up to call for impeaching Kavanaugh. Ted Lieu, a Democrat from Los Angeles County, has asked the question, should we begin to see if he should be impeached? And Gerald Nadler apparently was reined in when he said that if he chairs the Judiciary Committee, he will investigate Kavanaugh. He stopped short of calling for impeachment. And so this is what the Democrats are offering. In a climate where Trump is doing a magnificent job as a demagogue and turning his angry mobs into the constitutional defenders who are fighting off the angry mobs of Democrats who tried to smear Brett Kavanaugh and use underhanded means to block his appointment and confirmation to the Supreme Court. And I'm sorry to say that I think that this totally fabricated Republican narrative is going to carry more weight, convince more voters, get more partisans to the polls than this limp-wristed approach by the Democrats. And while we hear Democrats talk about the real dangers to our near and long-term survival as a republic, they don't act like that when you challenge them to take political action. And here's a piece from 2 days ago in the New York Times, where the headline reads, "Impeach Kavanaugh? Both sides are up for the fight." They talk about an event in Detroit last weekend, Fems for Dems. They were expecting 50 people to show up, but 250 people plus a 50-person waiting list responded to the invitation. And this is seen as the base being energized and really wanted to do something. But our political leaders say, sit down, shut up, we know what's better for you because we have big cash contributed by corporate interests and it pays for polling that tells us how to calibrate our message and avoid being seen as too extreme. While Trump champions extremism. And it works for them. Now, I don't believe that everything is mirrored and that the Democrats can just use the same underhanded tactics of the Republicans and prevail. No, you have to confront them. You have to fight. And Chris Coons, the Delaware senator who trusted Senator Flake, thought that pause for the FBI extended investigation was going to do something? Well, he's proving to be such a sellout. He said, you know, talking about impeaching Kavanaugh at this point isn't necessarily healing us and moving us forward. Well, we're not going to heal. We're not going to move forward, Coons. Are you crazy? Don't you see what Trump does every time he stages one of these mob rallies? And then the omniscient voice of the New York Times, the gray lady, speaks. Now, this is not in quotes. This is not attributed to any individual person. It just reads, even if Democrats proceed, it is unlikely they would be able to remove Justice Kavanaugh from the court. Well, that seals it. If the Times has decreed this, then no one should try. No leadership is required. There was a campaign for years to impeach Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, but it never happened. And only Justice Samuel Chase was actually impeached, but then not removed during an action back in the 1800s. And so if you haven't yet, I encourage you to listen to my conversation with John Bonifaz about impeaching Kavanaugh. Again, it's not something that happens quickly, but it is feasible. And I recognize that even if the Democrats regain the House and they don't regain the Senate, it's an uphill struggle there. We've got to stand for something. We've got to say this is not acceptable. But we don't. In an op-ed over at BuzzFeed today, a guy named Sean McElwee co-founder of Data for Progress. He makes the case that if we can't impeach Kavanaugh, we should impede the conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court. And he lays out a litany of ideas here. He says the time has come for a new effort to constrain the court, limit its power, and use public opinion and elite opinion to try to rein them in. He suggests we use advertising and communications to drive up the negatives of the conservative justices, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and now Kavanaugh. He says getting cameras into the courtroom would demystify the proceedings. The progressives should design laws to be more difficult for the court to strike down. And the Democrats should consider adding two or more new justices. Now, that requires a Democrat in the White House and Democrat majorities in both houses. These strike me as interesting ideas, but not really actionable in the immediate future. And one more about Brett Kavanaugh. I dare you to pull out your phone or your computer and go to brettkavanaugh.com. Hopefully you'll spell it with two T's and all those A's in Kavanaugh. And what you'll find is a portal for sexual assault victims. The URL was picked up by a group called Fix the Court. There's a link to their site at the brettkavanaugh.com site. And they want to reform the Supreme Court with term limits and some limits on their outside income and things like that. But the website headlines We Believe Survivors and reads, the start of Kavanaugh's tenure on the court may look like a victory for one interest group or another, but more importantly, it is putting a national focus on the issue of sexual assault. Take a look. Now, yesterday, our junior senator from California, Kamala Harris, had a few minutes to grill Christopher Wray, the latest FBI chief, and she asked him about that renewed background investigation that Jeff Flake prompted after he voted for confirming him but said, let's wait a week. And Chris Wray, carefully choosing his words, said that, yes, it was limited in scope. He wouldn't say who at the White House defined the scope. When asked if it was Don McGahn, the White House counsel, he did not answer. And when pointedly asked if the FBI had investigated whether Kavanaugh committed perjury, misleading Congress in his public testimony, Wray had this odd answer. He said, that's not something I could discuss here. The hell does that mean? I can't explain it. I think a simple answer was indicated. Yes, we investigated perjury, or no, that was not in the instruction brief from the White House. And I'm not sure why Harris allowed him to be coy about that. So one of the comments that he made at the hearing, Chris Wray, FBI director, right now as I sit here, we're currently investigating about 5,000 terrorism cases across America and around the world. About 1,000 of those cases are homegrown violent extremists, and they're in all 50 states. In the last year or so, we've made hundreds of arrests of terrorism subjects. And this segues, I think, beautifully into information that I want to thank listener Linda Lewis for tipping me off about. Because, as you know, I'm selective about what I cover in the podcast. I'm not talking about Hurricane Michael. I can't handle natural disasters and big events like that. The corporate media, they'll go wall to wall and give you what you want there. But I cover the issues that I'm passionate about. And as you know, I am deeply upset at the way the FBI used the Patriot Act and the events of 9/11 to create a new police state entity in this country that routinely frames so-called domestic terrorism suspects. And so when I heard about that limo crash in Schoharie, New York, that killed 18 people in the car and two pedestrians, I said, well, that's a local story. I'm really sorry to see that. I'm sad that the limo wasn't taken off the road after it failed an inspection. But Linda Lewis sent me coverage from the Times Union, an upstate New York paper, that exposed that the man who owned the limo whose name is Hussein, Nauman Hussein. He is the son of a guy named Hussein, and the family owns a motel and this limo service. They apparently had as many as 4 or 5 limos at a given time. But what's key here is that the younger Hussein became an informant after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He was arrested in an FBI fraud investigation in Albany, accused of being a corrupt translator who also took bribes to help non-citizens or non-speakers get driver's licenses. Well, following his arrest in the fall of 2001, he agreed to become a paid informant to the FBI. He had emigrated from Pakistan in 1993, had a green card, and when he went to work for the FBI, he helped frame a series of domestic terrorism suspects. There were 2 people arrested in 2004, accused of laundering money in connection with a fictitious terror plot, completely set up by the FBI's informant. Those 2 men were convicted in 2006, sentenced to 15 years in prison. And one of the attorneys for those men who were convicted, Terrence Kindlin, knew the younger Hussein. In fact, one of his kids apparently was a driver for the limo service for a while. And he had harsh words for the man. He said that, he gave translations to the FBI that were not reliable. He referred to Hussein as a confidence man who could not be trusted. Then in 2009, Hussein, the informant, resurfaced in the Newberg case. And you may have known about that when it was turned into a documentary feature that some people saw. Then in 2012, Shahed Hussein again took part in an undercover FBI sting, this time targeting a 34-year-old man who lived near Pittsburgh. It'll be interesting to see what the FBI does with its former paid informant in the liability for this extremely deadly limo incident. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Dick Attlee in Maine, Billy Cook in Eureka, California, Jeff Stewart, Terry Paris in the People's Republic of Berkeley. I really am grateful to you for your support. And it's my soft pitch way of asking others to join in. So let me be a little more direct. You, with the earbuds on, you listen every day. You get something out of this podcast. Can you chip in $5 a month? I saw you nod your head. Visit peterbcollins.com. Click menu. Click become a subscriber. You land on the sign-up page. And from there, I think it's pretty easy to figure out how you can select a subscription that fits your budget. Have you heard the case of Laura Alkasim? Alkasim, perhaps? She is the daughter of Palestinians. She is a U.S. citizen. She went to the University of Florida, and she became president of their chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, a group that supports BDS aimed at Israel, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, Laura has spent the last week in custody at Ben-Gurion Airport in Israel. She arrived with a valid student visa, but Israeli intelligence had the book on her. They knew about her background, and they have detained her now for over a week as she appeals a deportation order. Now, I don't want to offer any judgment here, but this young woman, apparently, feeling the pressure, has told the Israelis she never actively participated in boycott campaigns, and she promised that she wouldn't do them in the future. And maybe it's because she has been, she's planning to study in Israel, and she has a visa to do that. And so she's decided to tell them what they want. But what is most surprising to me is an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times yesterday. And I've been wary of these 2 people since they were added to the columnist lineup at the Times, Brett Stevens and Barry Weiss. And, for example, I learned from the fine print of this op-ed that Brett Stevens used to be the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Somehow I missed that when he was added to the opinion page at the Times. And Barry Weiss, who is too frequent a guest on Bill Maher's show, and he never defines her politics or her extreme support of Israel. She is a staff editor, and she writes for the opinion section. So the two of them opened this piece about the young American woman who's trapped at Ben-Gurion Airport by quoting a slam against them by Andrew Sullivan. You may know him. He's an outspoken writer in his own right. Because Sullivan had described Stevens and Weiss as a Zionist fanatic of near unhinged proportions. And they said, look, just remove the word near. We are happy to plead guilty as charged to being Zionist fanatics of unhinged proportions. Now, I'm glad that they have outed themselves appropriately. They go on to say, and I agree with this, that even unhinged Zionists can level criticism at Israeli policies. And the story of Lara Alkassen is a case in point. So they recite the details that I just told you. They add that Catherine Frank, Columbia professor, was interrogated, deported from Israel earlier this year. In August, Simone Zimmerman, an American Jewish activist who lives in Israel, founder of If Not Now, was held for more than 3 hours and quizzed on her political views at an Israeli border. And Peter Beinart, a well-known writer and a left-wing Zionist, was detained at Ben-Gurion Airport on his way to his niece's bat mitzvah. And even a pro-Israel leader, Meyer Koplow, the chairman of Brandeis University's board, a pro-Israel philanthropist, was aggressively interrogated at Ben-Gurion Airport because he had some sort of a brochure in his luggage that appeared to be pro-Palestinian. So, here's the argument from Weiss and Stevens. I don't agree with this, but I'll quote it. Israelis have good reason to see the BDS campaign as a thinly veiled form of bigotry. Boycotts of Jewish businesses have a particularly foul pedigree in Nazi Germany. Well, what the hell does that have to do with this case? That's just so extraneous and emotional. The same activists who obsessively seek to punish and isolate Israel for its occupation of the West Bank rarely, if ever, display the same passion for protesting against China for its occupation of Tibet or Russia for its occupation of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Well, those are different issues. And they also don't oppose, the Saudi regime. They are focused on one issue. And these are just distractions that they list here. But they go on to say, Israel, like all countries, has a right to protect its borders and determine who's allowed in and out. But Israel's also a state that prides itself on being a liberal democracy. If liberalism is about anything, it's about deep tolerance for opinions we find foolish, dangerous, or antithetical to our own. The case for such liberalism today is both pragmatic and principled. In practice, expelling visitors who favor the BDS movement does little, if anything, to make Israel more secure. I agree with them here. It powerfully reinforces the prejudice of those visitors that Israel is a discriminatory police state. Amen, Barry and Brett. And they close by saying, here's a better way. Invite them to visit. No restrictions, no minders, no lectures. Perhaps they'll find their prejudices confirmed, but we suspect that more than a few of them might find their views changed. Well, I respect the conclusion that they reach in that piece. I want to commend Whitney Webb, who is a reporter for Mint Press News, for providing data that supports my bias. It was just a couple of days ago that I was lamenting that the New York Times is using the source Bellingcat to report on the allegations of the suspects who they say are responsible for the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury, England. But Whitney Webb helps us understand Bellingcat, its connections to The Intercept and Pierre Omidyar's First Look Media. Their connections to Google, which of course is a major military and intelligence contractor. And the article opens with a description of an event in New York recently, a workshop where The Intercept hosted the Google-funded organization Bellingcat. And we're seeing Bellingcat getting more and more respectability in corporate media outlets. And I want to encourage you to read this. I have much more to cover today, and so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. But this is an important piece that shows that Bellingcat is probably a tool of U.S. and perhaps other intelligence agencies. And it is one to be treated with great skepticism and should not be considered a legitimate source, in my opinion. Tomorrow, I'm scheduled to interview Gareth Porter, a frequent contributor to this podcast, who published a piece at Consortium News yesterday entitled "The Shaky Case That Russia Manipulated Social Media to Tip the 2016 Election." I've linked to the article so you can read it if you like, and we'll amplify those issues in my in-depth interview with Gareth Porter tomorrow. A 28-year-old California man has been sentenced to 6 months in prison for selling bank account information that helped Russia with their social media campaign that our friend Gareth Porter considers a shaky case. This man, Richard Pinedo, fully cooperated when the FBI came after him. He is described as an unwitting aider and abettor of the claimed Russian efforts to meddle in our election by manipulating social media. And the point is that he enabled people to set up PayPal accounts that would obscure where the money was coming from and where the money was going to. And he was a low-level actor who, you know, was working with people who were committing petty fraud, not alleged international espionage. So this becomes another scalp for Bob Mueller. And we're going to hear the promoters of the Russiagate narrative say, see, here's another one. Only this guy doesn't have any connection whatsoever to the Trump campaign. There is no claim of any collusion with Trump, with Russian actors, or anybody else. He was purely in it to make money. And he's accused of being used by Russian agents to set up a couple of accounts. And in the corporate media, this is thundered as just another big development in the Mueller investigation, when in fact it does not advance the original claims one iota. Sunday's New York Times Magazine had a cover story. The cover reads, "Every Vote Counts." You open up to the middle. The article is entitled "The Crisis of Election Security." What a waste of time. And color ink. And paper. This New York Times article is a rehash of ancient issues about direct record electronic voting machines and about the vulnerabilities in America's election system. But it doesn't touch on interstate cross-check. It doesn't talk about the purges that are underway right now in Georgia and Indiana. It doesn't even hint at looking at the issues from Michigan in 2016, where we saw people who went to the polls and voted down ticket reflected no vote for president. And that was in Wayne County, Detroit, and in the county where Flint is located. And Greg Palace says it totals some 75,000 ballots where no vote for president was reflected in a state that was delivered to Trump for a mere 12,000 or 11,000 vote margin. Well, over at Who, What, Why, I want to commend Harmon Leon for a piece about the situation in Georgia, exposing the exact match policy, which began as an initiative by the man who is currently running for governor, Brian Kemp, as he was Secretary of State. But it is now part of the law in Georgia, and the smallest disparity on a registration form lands the prospective voter in a pending status list. And there are some 50,000 people whose status is pending. They're allegedly in one file drawer somewhere in Atlanta. And this is used as a pretext to keep people from voting. There are 53,000 new voter registrations currently on hold in Georgia because of exact match. And African Americans comprise 70% of the challenged registrations, even though they only reflect 32% of the state's population. It's an important article, and Brian Kemp is hoping to suppress the vote just enough for him to get elected in November. Our friend Pepe Escobar has a brilliant piece loaded with literary and pop culture references. And as you may know, Pepe Escobar is an expatriate of Brazil. He can't live there anymore, he's told me many times, because of the politics that has descended, and descended even further. Stripped to its essence, he writes, the current Brazilian presidential elections represent a direct clash between democracy and an early 21st century neo-fascism, indeed between civilization and barbarism. The Brazilian dilemma illuminates all the contradictions surrounding the right populist offensive across the West, juxtaposed to the inexorable collapse of the left. He notes that 69% of Brazilians profess their support for democracy, which he deduces means that 31% do not. And he says that the term dystopia central doesn't even begin to describe what's going on. It is a brilliant analysis of what is going on, and you can tell how much Pepe Escobar loves his country and feels so much at odds in his self-imposed exile. It's a great read. Please do check it out. Well, the case of the missing Saudi journalist who was living in the United States, Jamal Khashoggi, or Khashoggi, who once was very tight with the Saudi royal family, and he was critical of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his so-called reform policies. Turkey remains adamant that Khashoggi was killed at the consulate of Saudi Arabia, located in Istanbul. They know he entered the building, but nobody saw him leave. Turkey has released the names of 15 Saudis who were flown in from Riyadh in two flights that day. Turkish officials have told the Middle East Eye that Khashoggi was ushered to the consul general's office when he entered the building, then quickly seized by two men. We know when Jamal was killed, in which room he was killed, and where the body was taken to be dismembered. But the Saudis, after pledging cooperation, are not permitting Turkish investigators into their consulate. And over here in the U.S. of A., Bob Corker, the lame duck senator from Tennessee, and 21 others sent a formal letter to the president triggering a mandatory U.S. investigation into Khashoggi's fate. Under the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act, the administration would have to report on the conclusions of that investigation and a decision on any sanctions against the perpetrators. And let me pause for a minute to say I got a nice email from Brian Carey, who found the link and watched the documentary about Bill Browder that I talked about just a couple of weeks ago here. And he said it really did help expose the real motives of Bill Browder and the way he has successfully manipulated many governments, including the United States, into attacks on Russia, sanctions, all based on the narrative that Bill Browder offers about his former accountant, or was he a lawyer, named Magnitsky. And the Khashoggi disappearance is creating problems for Crown Prince Jared Kushner, because he cultivated Mohammed bin Salman, their crown prince, elevating him to a key ally. We know in one case he fed him some classified information that put Kushner's security clearance at risk, but, oh, that's been papered over. Anyway, this does set up quite a scene, and if the allegations are proven, it'll be a big setback for Saudi Arabia, or it should be, in terms of its relationship with the United States. Now, the Saudis may feel that they've got Trump's approval. After all, he went and did that lightsaber dance with them early in his tenure. And one observer, the former ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Feirstein, said it does seem like the Saudis are less concerned about U.S. views than ever before, both because they assume Trump won't care and because they don't think they need U.S. approval. Now, there's an event next week that many people are starting to boycott. It's an investor conference in Riyadh. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Also, Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Steve Schwarzman, chief executive of the Blackstone Group, and the chief executive of Uber. They're all planning to attend, but the New York Times has withdrawn its sponsorship of the event, raising the question, why were they ever a sponsor to begin with? But Trump has signaled clearly that human rights don't matter. That even if this is proven that the Saudis lured this guy to their consulate and then brutally murdered him and dismembered him, Trump says, well, you know, blocking arms sales to Saudi Arabia would not be acceptable to me. Now, this situation, he said, we don't like it, not even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing that they have four or five alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me. So keeping the U.S. number one as the world's arms merchant, and selling advanced fighter jets and warfare tools to a country that abuses, just in Yemen, we know what they've been doing. Trump signals that he supports greed over human rights. Earlier this week, Trump put his name on an op-ed that was published in USA Today attacking the concept of Medicare for All. And the fact-checkers at the Washington Post say, in which almost every sentence contained a misleading statement or falsehood. He falsely claims that expanding Medicare to more people would end Medicare as we know it and take away benefits that seniors have paid for their entire lives. That's not the proposal at all. And he knows it. Here's just one more. He wrote, as a candidate, I promised we would protect coverage for patients with pre-existing conditions and create new healthcare insurance options that would lower premiums. I have kept that promise. We're now seeing health insurance premiums coming down. Well, only for bogus coverage. You can buy a shitty policy for a really low price, but... oh, yeah. And Trump is also bullying the Federal Reserve for their recent increases in interest rates. Jay or Jerome Powell, who was selected by Trump to be his chair of the Fed, is the subject of attacks. Trump told reporters before his rally in front of a mob in Pennsylvania last night, I think the Fed has gone crazy. And in bullying the Federal Reserve, Trump is breaking ranks with traditional policy of allowing them to operate independently. And he can't help it. You just know that. And my last story today is about the third Mrs. Trump, First Lady Melania, who gave an interview to ABC that airs Friday night in which she said that she could be the most bullied person in the world. And that's why she is running her initiative to end online bullying. Of course, she ignores that her husband is the biggest online bully in the country. And this claim shows that she shares with her hubby paranoia and victimization. So as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, yes, this is a long one. I'm catching up on 2 days of coverage, but I promise to share with you the two phone calls that I made responding to robocalls to my cell phone, which are the most annoying calls you can get, threatening me that the IRS is investigating me and I needed to call them back right away. So I got on the phone and made the call twice.
Thank you for calling Internal Revenue Service. How can I help you? Good afternoon.
Hi. I got a phone call about a lawsuit from the IRS. Can you explain that?
Yes. In order to me to pull out your information, can I have your first name, your last name, and your zip code?
Absolutely not. Who are you?
Then you can simply hang up the line.
Well, you're a fraud. That sounds like all the IRS agents that I've talked to over the years. How about you? I called back on a different line.
Thank you for calling Internal Revenue Service. This is Officer Mark Kevin. How can I help you?
Yes, Officer Mark, how are you today?
I'm fine.
Hi, great. And I'm really upset. I got one of these really bad robocalls from you guys. And it says that the IRS is filing a lawsuit against me?
Can you please verify me your first name, last name, and your zip code so I can pull out your information and see what is this all about and what's going on?
Well, Officer Mark, you don't sound like you're an American. You don't sound like you work for the IRS. Why should I trust you? Hello, Mark?
I give you my batch ID number.
Yeah, but Mark, this is bullshit. You're a fraud. You're running a fraudulent operation. We know that. How many people fall for this on a daily basis, Mark? I mean, do people actually give you their name and their information? Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.